So if we called this book an earthly book, why is that a good description? It's an earthly book. Over and over, the perspective of the writer is when he looks at life under the sun, or sometimes he just says this life, but it's the idea of looking at things from a pure earthly standpoint. But how do you reconcile that with the fact that it's in a collection of writings that claim to be, and we believe, are divinely inspired? An earthly book that's divinely inspired. How do you reconcile those things? He had done it all.
I didn't say that. He did it all. You know what I'm saying?
And how is that serving us as divine communication, his experiences and his observations? I mean, if it's just all about earthly living, what heavenly benefit, what spiritual benefit is it?
This under the sun perspective gives contrast between just life on this earth without God, without hope. This is all there is, contrasted with eternal life with God through Jesus.
Okay. I suppose there are two ways in which a person can start on a journey toward God. One is they're pulled, or the other they're pushed. And I think both are biblically legitimate, that knowing God and pursuing God can pull us to Him, but then sometimes our sins or our experiences or things that happen to us can push us to want to find something better than this life, which is happening in this book. This book is pushing us above the sun, so to speak, if you're using the geographic reference there. So God is, through this man's observations about life under the sun, God is teaching us. He's revealing things to us. And I want you to think about this too, that this is telling us, since this is divinely inspired, that God understands life under the sun. It'd be easy for us to conclude that God doesn't, because of who He is and where He dwells and so forth. And in a way, this is something God does in this book and some other places in the Old Testament that then He'll do on a grand scale later on. For instance, over and over and over, think about what we're told about Jesus. Just go on a quick trip with me, just a really quick side trip over to Hebrews chapter 2, where in trying to make the case that faith in Christ is superior to going back to Judaism, he's describing the glorious splendor and superiority of Jesus Christ. And the Hebrew writer says in Hebrews 2, verse 14, "Since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise partook of the same things." So you're talking about a limited perspective, and that is living in flesh and blood. Well, God the Son came and lived in flesh and blood. He came and put himself in that context, and he partook of the same things. Do we understand that the Son of God came and lived life under the sun? As good as he was, as wonderful as he was, as holy as he was, as wise as he was killed at 33 years of age. That doesn't sound like a successful life under the sun, does it? So actually, at the end of this class, we're going to spend one or two lessons on Ecclesiastes in the New Testament. And that's a little teaser there. But we understand that when Christ came to earth, it was God experiencing life in human flesh. And over, since he did that, the New Testament is teaching us, don't you understand that Christ relates to you? He understands you. He gets it. Well, you know, the truth is God had gotten it all along. Ecclesiastes shows that. But in Christ, there is a flesh and blood demonstration that God gets life under the sun. So sometimes you can read this book and you feel like you're in a secluded room from the rest of the Bible. It's like, okay, there's the rest of the Bible, there's Ecclesiastes. It's easy to do that. Very easy to do that. It's just like a wall. It's got plumbing and wires that connects to other parts of the house. Ecclesiastes connects over and over and over. Okay, let's jump into chapter 9. Chapter 9 is, in a way, a continuation. Look back in verse 17 and remind yourself of what he's saying in verse 17 of chapter 8. What's the point that he's been emphasizing, actually, for a couple of chapters, and off and on since really about chapter 3? And what's the point here he again makes in chapter 8, verse 17, about humans trying to understand life? As far as what happens and when and why, what does chapter 8, 17 say?
He cannot discover.
He cannot discover exactly what's happening and why. But who does know? God.
God. And I think we have to realize that's an under the sun statement.
Uh-huh.
That without the revelation from God, you can't.
Exactly. So, look at this. All right, Rick, read chapter 9, verse 1. Just the first verse.
For I've taken all this to my heart and explained it that righteous men, wise men, and their deeds are in the hand of God. Man does not know whether it will be love or hatred. Anything awaits him.
Okay. Once again, he's just depicting that life is in God's hands. This is a continuation, I think, of that previous statement there. In a way, this can almost belong back in chapter 8. Okay? It's the recognition of God's sovereignty / control. God controls because he's sovereign. Since he's sovereign, he's in control. They go together. And look what it says about the potential future. Depending on your translation, but it roughly says something like whether love or hate. In this context, it's the idea of whether you see that good or bad is happening to you. In other words, it's in God's hands. But when you experience life, you either feel like you're being loved or hated. Sometimes you just have this day, it's like everything falls in place. And you feel like somehow, and I'm going to borrow non-biblical expressions here, like the cosmic forces of the universe are in your favor. And then other days, you feel like the, quote, whole world's against you. You feel hated. So whether we feel loved or hated as life unfolds, we don't know. Okay? I think this is in reference to the context, the flow of life, in determining whether God's working against us or for us. He hates us or he rejects us or he's trying to favor us or whatever. We can't look at events of life and make that determination, can we? We'll get it wrong. And what's the classic case? We started the year reading about this. What's the classic case of looking at the events of life and interpreting what God's up to? Job is a really great cross-reference, this book.
God is always for us. We've got to remember, if we're here or if we're here, he's for us.
Right.
Just so, if everybody around here disagrees with you, God is for you.
Right.
You've got to remember, he's in his will.
Right.
And that's what that's how I can make it.
Sure. That's what you call living by faith. The Bible teaches us that, you know, like Romans chapter 8, if he gave his son, if he's willing to give his son for us, that's the ultimate expression of he's on our side, then he'll give us all things. Life under the sun, though, means you're just trying to interpret things, not through what God has revealed and what he has done, but rather you're trying to interpret through the events of life what God thinks of you. It's going to mess you up. And I think humans gravitate toward that thinking. That when things are going well for me, I'm favored by God. When things are not going well, I'm disfavored by God. And it's true, we have teachings that say that there are ways in which we're blessed when we do things right before God. But that's not always the explanation as to why things go well. As Jesus taught, the rain falls on whom? And by the way, we think of rain as something negative. Oh, it's rained all day. No. In ancient Palestine, what was rain? It's a blessing. It's a blessing. It falls on the just and the unjust. Okay, with that in mind, okay, ready for another hammer upside the head? Why not? Okay, 2-10. Les, will you read those verses, please?
All things come alike to all. One event happens to the righteous and to the wicked. To the good, the clean, and the unclean. To him who sacrifices and him who does not sacrifice. As is the good, so is the sinner. He who takes an oath, as he who fears an oath. Number 3-2. This is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that one thing happens to all. Truly, the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil. Madness is in their hearts while they live, and after that, they go to the dead.
Through 10.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But for him who is joined to all the living, there is hope, for a living dog is better than a dead lion. For the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing, and they have no more reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. Also, their love and their envy have now perished. Nevermore will they have a share in anything done under the sun. Go, eat your bread with joy, and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already accepted your works. Let your garments always be white, and let your head lack no oil. Live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life, which he has given you under the sun, all your days of vanity, for that is your portion in life and in the labor which you have performed under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might, for there is no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you are going.
All right, thank you. I think it's good to put this section together. There's a cohesiveness about it. When he starts off here and he says in verse 2, it's the same for all, the same event happens to all, what's he talking about? So he's talking in this reading here about death and life. I mean, it's just very simple here. What's the pattern regarding who dies? Everybody. What if you're a righteous person and you're a worshiping person? You die. What if you care less about God? You don't make any sacrifices to him and you're unholy? You die. Okay? It's that common kind of denominator. Okay? This is where he hits you upside the head with a hammer, but then he says, oh, don't fall down, keep walking. Because he says here, rotten as that is, what's better than death?
Life.
Matter of fact, as he says about the animals, what does he say about animals? That's right. Our dog, for some reason, we're about to leave this morning, come over. Our dog went to the door, was standing at the door. Of course, she's got dementia. She does crazy things. But she's standing at the door, and I thought, she wants to go to church with us. I thought, no, that's not for you. Get back, you know. And I thought, but we are talking about you today. And she's the opposite of a lion. She's this big. I told you the other day, she almost has no teeth now. But she's living. And some lions are dead. So, again, let's come back to it. Life under the sun. Now, we know so much in the New Testament about the afterlife. You understand that? The Old Testament says very little about the afterlife. So, through Christ, we have so much revelation about the afterlife. But this is life under the sun. And life under the sun, it's better to be alive than to be dead. Because what does he say here? What are the disabilities of death? What does he say? All gone? Everything's gone?
Forgotten.
Can't do anything, good or bad?
Forgotten.
And generally, you're forgotten. Generally, you're forgotten. How many people look at tombstones? And by the way, that's going out in a way, But how many people even look at tombstones? Just a handful of people. And once about two generations die, nobody except somebody who's doing some obscure research. And they write and write and write, and 12 people read what they write about. And then they die, and people forget about what they wrote about. Okay.
I had a college professor who asked the question, how many of you know the first and last names of your great-great-grandparents?
Right. There you go.
Even your own family.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly right. Yeah. Listen.
I remembered something from a lecture that I heard from Richard Dawkins, which most people in here know that he's the one of the premier spokesmen for atheism and evolution in the world today from England. And one of the things that I remembered him saying one time was that Ecclesiastes was his favorite book in the Bible. And we've been studying through Ecclesiastes, I've kind of been thinking about reading it through his eyes and through his understanding. And a number of times I've come to this conclusion, but this part here is even more definitive as to why I think he likes it. Because an atheist would like it, because it describes what an atheist sees. He sees everything the same. He eliminate the few references to God from the book of Ecclesiastes, and you've got the ideal atheist synopsis, that everything's the same, everybody dies, there's no justice, there's no reason to it, you can't figure it out, it's beyond your knowing, and that's the way an atheist sees it. And so that's, yeah, it just...
Yeah. So, in light of that, this is where the book has benefit in that this puts this salt on the tongue of how tragic this is, how pointless life is. Is there something more? Okay, and so the revelation that comes to us through Christ, which is embodied in all the writings of the New Testament, even the letters, how much more meaningful it is that we have that revelation about life after death. But it's after you get this salt on the tongue right here and you're left thirsting, then you're really ready, okay, kind of thing for that, okay? So from the point of life under the sun, there is no life after death. Now, I want to make a little side venture here into something, and I want to throw this chart up here. And this is a great, once again, Les and I did not coordinate this. Just want you to know, Les and I are not secretly planning this together, but it goes exactly with what you were saying, Les, okay? So, all right, let's take all the God references out of Ecclesiastes. What happens without God's guidance and God's understanding of God when the vanity of life really hits you? Well, two things, and it may be one before the other, but I think disillusionment hits most people first. And then it leaves you in despair. And so if you keep God out of it, now what happens with the wise preacher of Ecclesiastes? He has disillusionment and despair, but he keeps coming back to God. He'll eventually get back to God at the end, but he has God all through it. Without God, what I think happens is a destructive way of life. And I think it's two ways. Sometimes it's actively destructive. People do reckless things. They mess up their body and their health with drugs and alcohol. They mess up all their relationships. They don't care what their spouse or their kids think, and they just do what they want to do. Other people are passively destructive. They're so disillusioned and they're in despair, they do nothing. And it's sort of like you just take a house in a yard or a farm and do nothing. What happens over time? It all grows up and falls in and just collapses. You don't clean anything, mow anything, paint anything, caulk anything, treat anything. I mean, and it just falls into disrepair. And I think that's what happens to people inside out, is they may not go out and destroy themselves openly, but they just don't look for God. They just sort of exist. And passively, they end up the dead lion. And they don't rise above that, okay? And I think that's where you end up. And we talked about the other day about suicide. This is the world. It doesn't matter whether it's 21st century America or 19th century Britain or 15th century India. It doesn't matter. This is the world right here. And every culture has its own little flavor of this. But that's the world. And that's why we've read all these quotes, highbrow and lowbrow, that reflect this, right? Yeah, no purpose, no direction.
Yes, that's what I love about Psalms 23. You know, I had to really think about it. I drive a bus that, well, green pastures, waters, smooth moving brook. Why do I need this? You know, well, yeah, I need things smoothed out. A smooth marriage, a smooth job. What, you know, I need that. Yeah. So I don't destroy myself, you know, make bad judgments. Or,
right.
He guides me.
Right. That's exactly right. And so then it's a sort of an odd transition here. But after he talks about, again, it's a hammer, it's a sledgehammer. Death comes to all. Look what he says at the end of verse 6. You know, and forever they are no more. They no more share in all that's done under the sun. And then he goes, go. Go, which is an active statement. Go and do what? Go and be happy. Okay. That's right.
Do your job and do a good job.
Okay, right. Go and live. Go and live now. Death is finally coming, but live now. You know, we've all heard the expression, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Did you know that that is really from Ecclesiastes? Now, cultures have taken the idea and sort of phrased it different ways, but when you trace where this originally came from, most people credit Ecclesiastes from this. Now, what some people mean by that is, well, since we're dying anyway, it doesn't matter how you live. No, Ecclesiastes, even in this chapter, we'll see it, it does matter how you live. But even though we're going to die, live. There's a way you should live, but live. Okay? Which doesn't leave you in that despair. Okay? Earl, did you have your hand up?
I was just going to say, don't worry,
yeah. Yeah. There's some other songs that would apply from the flip side of not despair, but and there's poetry and songs that do address the concept of life is hard, but it's okay. Carter Family, Keep on the Sunny Side. It opens up with, and I didn't plan this, so it opens up, I'm rusty, it opens up with, there's a dark and a troubled side of life. Come on. Now, this crowd, I expect this crowd to come through with me. Okay? There's a dark and a troubled side of life. Okay? But there's a bright and sunny side too. I kept looking toward Les. I thought, Les is my man. Les has got to be my man on this.
Faith over fear.
That's right. Yeah, and it's you got to make the best of what you're going through. So yeah, Sunnyside is great. It's probably more Ecclesiastes than like Dust in the Wind because it has both. So there we go. Okay, so there's the song we need to listen to this afternoon. Okay, and look at the urgency of the tone. Go and live now. Why the urgency?
Don't despair.
You don't want to get pulled out into despair. Yeah. And of course, go ahead and live now because what's coming? And when's it coming?
Soon.
Could be any time. Could be any time. So, and like verse 10 is the anti-despair counterbalance. Because if you despair, you just give up and do nothing, right? Actually, this says, and in spite of the fact that he has said over and over, all of our toil is vanity, he says in verse 10, what? About our toil, our work.
Do it to the best of your ability.
Whatever you're doing, do it with all your might. This is like the statement made by Paul in Colossians 3 to bond servants. You know, do it with all your might. Live and live with energy and action. I mean, I don't know about you, but when I have disillusionment and despair, I just want to do nothing. I mean, that's an easy thing to fall into. This is saying, no, go get up and live. Okay? It reminds me a little bit, this is a rough illustration, of there's a family or there's a setting where something heavy is going on. Maybe the husband and wife, they don't know how they're going to pay the bills that month, or maybe they've got a relative that's about to die or something. And then there are some 5 and 6-year-olds over here in the next room, and what are they doing? They're playing. Now, we understand that you can't not get real about life and go through with blinders on. Obviously, this man is not endorsing that because he's got all the blinders off. Okay? So, you know, kids don't understand the gravity of the negative things going on. But in their little cocoon, that is a wonderful way to just keep going and enjoy things. And there's a little bit of that we need. That there's a contentment in, because we accept life's going to be that way. And so there's a contentment in that acceptance and then an ability to have joy. I mean, you would think that if everything's going to fall apart, be useless, we're going to die in the end, there's no joy in anything. But by embracing this reality, and we free ourselves up from the anxiety about it, and accept it as the joy of from God. And this is the other thing, I'll get you, Rick. You know, the idea that just go and live and be happy, that is found in a lot of ancient literature. Just eat, drink, be merry. That idea for tomorrow we die is more Ecclesiastes. But the idea, you see that in a lot of really ancient texts and so forth. What all those ancient texts lack, everything from the Epic of Gilgamesh to the Greek philosophers, they don't really talk about God. Just enjoy the good things of life for them. But Ecclesiastes keeps telling us it's the gift of God. For instance, in chapter 9, verse 7, go eat bread with joy and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already approved of what you do. God's always a factor here. So that's the catalyst to the joy, is seeing that God wants you to enjoy your life anyway in spite of its vanity. Rick?
Well, I've always thought that was the point in the Sermon on the Mount when Jesus said, you know, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. They're the ones who can truly, those who honor God and serve Him and understand who He is, are the ones who can truly get what this earth has to offer.
Yeah, and then you can add to that in the Sermon on the Mount, don't fret over what you wear, what you eat, okay? Seek the kingdom. All these things will be added to you. Don't fret about those things. Okay? Yes.
Christ said, I came that you might have a fuller life.
Yeah. Yeah, an abundant life. Exactly. Yeah.
There's a little bit of between the lines is, through these passages is there, if there's something that you want to do, you better get on with it and do it. Like within the realm of righteous and good things. I'm not talking about evil things.
Right.
And the other part of that is that, you know, I think Earl and I were talking about this the other day, that if you look at history, the generations come and go through history. And you are a part, we are a part of a generation that will be, all of us will be gone in 100 years easily. So whatever good we're going to do, whatever influence we're going to have, whatever example we're going to be, we have to be it now. Because when we're dead, nobody, I mean, within a few generations, just like Rick said, you don't even remember anybody's name. I mean, there's just a handful of people that we actually know their names throughout history. Okay, we know Nebuchadnezzar. What about Nebuchadnezzar's, you know, wife? I mean, we know so little about the actual people who live in these generations throughout history. And we're in one. And then when we're gone, this group of people right here, we have no more influence in this world. And we better, so the point is, if you're going to do it, you better do it now.
Yeah. This is a good connection to the second chapter. Legacy is overrated because there's virtually no legacy for any of us. Life under the sun. So whatever impact this world, it's got to be right now. And it's part of that go and do, enjoy, go and work now and toil. Now we understand, and we'll get to that later, that there is a sense in which there is a work that's not vain. That is beyond life under the sun.
Yeah.
So, yeah, great, great insights. Very good. Let's look at verses 11 and 12. Rachel Messer, can you read those two verses for us, please? 11 and 12.
I again saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, and the battle is not to the warriors, and neither is bread to the wise, nor wealth to the discerning, nor favor to men of ability, for time and chance overtake them all. Moreover, man does not know his time, like fish caught in a treacherous net and birds trapped in a snare. So the sons of men are ensnared at an evil time when it suddenly falls on them.
All right, thank you. I'm just going to say this from a personal standpoint. This is the one text in this book that's brought me a lot of comfort. Vince, you and I were talking about this the other day, I think. What is this saying here? Well, note the transitional statement. He says, again I saw, or some translations, I returned and saw. So he's going back to trying to understand the meaning of life, the purpose of life, all these kinds of things. And he's going to draw some of the same conclusions, but he keeps coming back to this, okay? He's turning a new page, but by the end of the page, he's going to end up in the same place, but just more evidence. And what's the dose of reality that he serves up here? Yeah, the same kind of harsh reality and so forth. And specifically, what does he say? No control, time and chance. And leading up to that, what does he say? About who wins.
Not the person you think.
That's right. I mean, wow. The earlier you can learn that, the happier you'll be, okay? The race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong. And this is what Vince and I were talking about. Sometimes I look at somebody and they have a very important position of authority and influence, and they're like high up in a company or something like that. And I'm like, how in the world did they get that job? Who thought to put them in that position? And I've seen it. I've seen it in business. I've seen it in education. So the most qualified people I've seen to run a school have been the custodians, not the principals. I'm serious. Some of my junior and senior girls knew how to run a school better than some principals I've worked for. Okay, I'm out of education. I can say that. You agree with that, Hilton? You agree with that, Neil? Okay. It's like it's mind-boggling. And some of you, you know, in your companies and your, you know, you've seen it. And of course, we see it all the time in politics. Most really qualified people don't want to touch politics. Okay, usually people who are, they know better, okay? And all right, so you don't get that job. It's all right. Race is not always the swift, nor the battle of the strong, okay? You weren't the one that was picked for this. You know, it's just endless. And it's the idea that life isn't fair. Yeah, it's not how it works. And here's the thing about it. But in our culture, and I think in any culture, do the right thing and work hard and you'll succeed. Well, we've already seen in Proverbs, do the right thing and work hard has blessings. But it's no guarantee. And sometimes those who are not talented and don't work hard and are not able thrive. That's how it is.
Especially
yeah.
Wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, I think especially.
And
yeah.
That's what I was going to comment on is every presidential election, I'm always thinking it to myself, is there not anyone better? if Jesus Christ himself were running for president in our country today, I can guarantee you he would not win. Because he would tell the truth.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and he's opposed to all the cultural, you know, fads and trends that are popular in the world right now. He would tell the truth about it, and so he would be out. And whatever dunce you put in there, you know, is going to win over the Lord himself. And you know, the ultimate sort of illustration of this is, what would mankind do to God if they could get their hands on him? What did they do to God when they did get their hands on him?
Yeah.
It's a perfect illustration.
If he came today, I'm here to be your king, what do you think the outcome would be similar? But he doesn't rule by consent, does he? It's not how he rules. So, yeah.
What you said a while ago about somebody not getting a job and then they should be in positions, I'm going beyond a little bit. And we don't talk about it much. But when we leave, when we leave this life, when our spirit leaves our body, we're going to be doing something else. Now, that's as far as I'm going to go.
Yeah.
But we can look for it. Everything ain't going to be fair here. It's not going to be. This world is not our home. But there, it put us where we need to be.
Yeah.
And no one will stop.
Right.
It'd all be made right. I completely agree. Yeah, I completely agree. And when he says here, race is not the swift, battle the strong, he follows it up with time and chance happen to all. Okay, he said a lot about time in this book. And now the idea of chance, okay? Again, we think of providence and all those kinds of things, which are true. But this is life under the sun. And when you look at life under the sun, it can appear to be chaotic, haphazard, lucky, unlucky, chance. But we know from the wise preacher's perspective that chance means we don't understand what's happening and why and the timing of it, but we do know that it's in God's hands. It's just to us, it looks very random and chance-like, okay? And this is where, oh good, okay, this is where, in a way, in these last comments, as well as this section, goes right into verse 13 to 18. Look at those verses. Earl, would you read 13 to 18 for us?
Also this I came to see as wisdom under the sun, and it impressed me. There was a small city with few men in it, and a great king came to it, surrounded it, and constructed large siege works against it. But there was found in it a poor man, and he had delivered the city by his wisdom. Yet no one remembered that poor man. So I said, wisdom is better than strength, but the wisdom of the poor man is despised, and his words are not heeded. The words of the wise, heard in quietness, are better than shouting of a ruler among fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good.
All right, thank you. So, here he's coming back. He's balancing things out. Before you think that it doesn't matter how you live, he's going to say something about wisdom and that it has merit. But of course, as wisdom is practiced, understand that it's subject to the vanity of life. So the story is about somebody who saves a city through his wisdom. Although, what's his background? Who is he? Is he a somebody? It's a nobody. But his wisdom is used to save a city. But then, how's he treated? He's completely forgotten. So, Derek Kidner says this. He has a good commentary on Ecclesiastes. He says, this parable is not a moral tale to show what people should do. It's a cautionary tale to show what they're like. This is not how you should live. This is a tale about what people are like and how they treat wisdom and people who are wise. So there are several lessons here. First of all, wisdom can come from where? From anybody. What'd you say?
Unexpected
places, surprising places. Exactly right. And wisdom always has great value, because here in this circumstance, it saved the city. Okay, that's the underlying point here is that wisdom is a good thing. Wisdom has value. But as you live a wise life, we're still subject to the vanity of life, which means we're still going to have these frustrations and emptiness, even if you live a wise life. However, living a wise life is better than living as a fool. He talked about that in Ecclesiastes 2. You're going to come out way ahead. He also talked, we just saw the other night in Wednesday in chapter 8, even though a man may flourish in his evil and he may be a hypocrite and people praise him after he dies, still in the end, it's better to fear God. So ultimately, he's always going to say that. And even if someone is very wise and even if good wisdom is laid out there, don't be surprised if people what? Don't listen to it. Don't appreciate it. Either don't listen to it and follow it, or even when they do follow it, they forget and they don't appreciate it, those kinds of things. And look at those last seven, verse 17 and 18. You guys brought up politics. Look at verse 17 and 18. Look what gets all the attention and has the big impact. Verse 17, it's bluster, the shouting of a ruler. You say it louder, you say it often. You say it like it's true, whether it's true or not. You scream it. And then verse 18 talks about weapons of war, steel. Bluster and steel. Bluster and physical weapons. Those are the tools of humans. And typically on earth, that's what succeeds economically, politically, etc. But they're not always the wise thing.
And weapons of war are really a synonym for power.
Yeah, it is. It is the synonym for power. Exactly right. It's a representation of that. It's human. It's human. That's not where God's power is. I mean, look at Egypt had the probably Egypt had one of, if not the mightiest militaries on the planet in the days of Moses. But that mighty military couldn't spare them of the plagues. And then that mighty military was wiped clean, wasn't it, at the Red Sea. So that's nothing to God. That means nothing to God. So this is telling us that though wisdom is not appreciated, it's always superior. Now think about that as we try to live and proclaim the gospel. It's not always appreciated. But wisdom is what's going to spare and save the city. That truth doesn't change. Okay, thank you very much, and we'll look forward to coming into the last chapters here.